today on Against the Grain. Born a slave, Frederick Douglass became a leading abolitionist and a powerful orator. Juliet Hooker recognizes Douglass as a democratic thinker, one who looked to Latin America for instruction and inspiration. I'm C.S. Song. Juliet Hooker highlights Douglass's understanding of multiracial democracy and draws parallels to the present, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Why would Frederick Douglass, a monumental figure known for his efforts to end slavery, look south to Central America and the Caribbean? What could he, what did he find there that enriched his understanding of what democracy, multiracial democracy, was or could be? Juliet Hooker has written a book that presents Frederick Douglass as a radical democratic thinker, one who adjusted his views on issues like African-American emigration and U.S. expansionism based on his shifting understandings of whether multiracial democracy was realizable in the U.S. She also brings to light Douglass's strong advocacy of a right, a universal human right, to migration. Juliet Hooker's new book is Theorizing Race in the Americas, Douglass, Sarmiento, Du Bois, and Vasconcelos. She's an associate professor of government and of African and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. When Juliet Hooker joined me from the UT Austin campus, she began with these comments about Frederick Douglass and his claim to fame.
Douglass had an enormously influential and varied career. He, of course, begins his life as an enslaved person who essentially teaches himself to read, which was a crime for enslaved people at the time, manages to escape from slavery as a young man, and then rises to become perhaps the most prominent African-American orator and political leader of his time. He would go on, for example, to become, as I write about in the book, ambassador to Haiti. So he holds, after the Civil War, hugely important symbolic posts. But he's also shaping political discourse during his time, right? He becomes a key figure in the abolitionist movement prior to the Civil War. He forges his own ideas about slavery and how to eliminate it. And he becomes a thinker and a political leader in his own right. And so when we think about Douglass, I think we think about the enormous achievement of going from being somebody who's born into slavery and then creating this kind of monumental career as an essentially self-taught person. But we also have to think about him as somebody whose ideas have had an enormous legacy on subsequent African-American thinkers, right? Douglass has been described as someone whose ideas have shaped every African-American thinker who has come after him, either as a a figure who has to be critiqued or somebody who they want to model themselves after. So, for example, W.B. Du Bois, who is seen as the towering African-American intellectual of the 20th century, self-consciously positions himself at various points as Douglass's heir. So Douglass is really a monumental figure and an extraordinary person who lived this enormously interesting life.
Why did you choose to devote a chapter of your book, Theorizing Race in the Americas, to Frederick Douglass?
So the book is an analysis of ideas about race across the American hemisphere in both Latin America and the United States. And I do this by looking at four thinkers, two African Americans and two Latin Americans, and they're divided into two pairings, one from each region, and one pairing is two mid to late 19th century thinkers, and the second pairing is an early to mid 20th century pairing of thinkers. So Douglass is the first person in the first pairing that I write about. And I chose Douglas because one of the things that I think characterizes debates about race in both the United States and Latin America in the mid to late 19th century is this question of what kind of multiracial democracies can be created in these post-independence settler states. So these are states in which you had large numbers of European immigrants who come, who become the leaders of these independence movements that are successful, but that then have these large non-white populations. So they really have to grapple with this question of what are these states going to look like? What are these democracies going to look like? Are they going to be fully democratic or are they going to be racially hierarchical? And Douglas is someone who thinks very deeply and perhaps one of the people who's thinking most profoundly about these questions in the United States during his time. So we tend to think about him as an abolitionist leader who we should read for his ideas about slavery and his critique of slavery. But I actually think that the most interesting thing, or one of the most interesting aspects of Douglass's thought, is his grappling with this question of multiracial democracy. So I chose to focus on Douglass because I wanted to see how our view of Douglass's work would change if we read him as a theorist of democracy.
A theorist of democracy. And here, early in this chapter that we've agreed to talk about in your book, Theorizing Race in the Americas, specifically about Frederick Douglass, you bring up at least two notions of democracy. One of them, prominently, is a notion of fugitive democracy that Sheldon Wolin came up with, he being a political theorist and writer who taught at, among other places, Princeton. What did Wolin mean by fugitive democracy?
So Wolin uses the concept of fugitive democracy to really address this question of constitutionalism, of what the relationship between democracy and constitutionalism is. We tend to think about constitutionalism, that is, the coining in written text of the rules, right, by which a democratic polity should operate, as the safeguard of democratic politics. But one of the things that Wolin was concerned about was that, in fact, if we focus too much on the rules, on this sort of procedural questions of democracy, we lose what are for him really the essence of democracy. So he worried that democracies could become ossified, that they could become calcified, and that instead, he said, we need to think about, you know, radical politics, or let's say these revolutionary moments, not as the opposite of constitutionalism and therefore as a threat to democracy, but as actually moments of democratic renewal when the scope of the demos is being enlarged. So this idea of fugitive democracy speaks to this notion that democracy is never fully achieved, right? There's no fully democratic political community anywhere, and that it's instead a process, and that it's always fugitive. It's always evanescent, and that in fact, instead of being the sort of, you know, long existing state of things, is found in these fleeting moments when people mobilize to really enact democratic principles.
So you are interested, among other things, in what Douglass said or wrote about fugitive ex-slaves. You find that relevant to Wolin's notion of fugitive democracy, or that it in some ways maybe expands on or extends Wolin's notion. So let's first talk about what Douglass wrote about the experience of fugitive ex-slaves, their relationship to the law of the land, and how he viewed lawbreaking, which I guess is what fugitive ex-slaves inevitably did, how he viewed lawbreaking.
So this is a key issue for me in the book, because one of the things that I think is interesting about Wolin's concept of fugitive democracy, as useful as I think it is the fact that he uses the idea of, or the notion of fugitivity metaphorically, right? He isn't drawing on actual experiences of fugitivity. And so part of what I do in my reading of Douglass on slave law is to say, how would we have to rethink Wolin's notion of fugitive democracy if we were looking at the experience of actual fugitives, and in this case, of fugitive ex-slaves? And one of the things that we see with Douglass is that he, for example, is really clear about the fact that slaves have a complicated relationship to the law. And this is inevitable, right? To be a slave was to be property. To know yourself as more than property meant that you had to defy your master. For example, to learn to read was against the law. To steal food that you had helped to harvest or to plant was to break the law. So to assert your humanity under slavery was to engage in criminal acts. It was to break the law.
But is Wolin, is he saying that moments of democracy, perhaps evanescent and rare and episodic, is he saying that those moments necessarily involve following the law, adhering to the law?
No. So on this question, I don't think Wolin and Douglass are at odds. I think, you know, they're probably in agreement, right, that there is a way in which this concern with the rule of law can impede us from seeing the places and the sites where actual democratic politics is taking place. But I think what a discussion of Douglass's notion of the experience of fugitive ex-slaves adds to Wolin is that it allows us to see two things. One is it makes us ask, who are the people who might engage in these moments of democratic renewal that Wolin is pointing to, right? So who are the people who are most likely to engage in these acts that enlarge the demos? And what Douglass's analysis suggests is that it's those who are in the most precarious situations vis-a-vis citizenship, right? So it's people who are liminal citizens, who are not quite citizens, maybe citizens to be, as was the case with African Americans prior to emancipation, and to African Americans being granted citizenship, right? They weren't citizens, even when they were free. And fugitive slaves certainly were not citizens, yet they were, Douglass suggests in his What to the Slave is the 4th of July speech of 1852, right? He suggests that it is those who are fighting slavery who are in fact channeling the best principles of the U.S. democratic tradition, which he connects to the U.S. founding. So that's one way in which I think Douglass raises questions that Wolin doesn't address. The other way in which he, dealing with Douglass's ideas can enlarge Wolin's concept is because he points to what happens after you become a fugitive, right? So Douglass's thought points to the ways in which fugitivity, by necessity, is something that might persist as an enhanced democratic subjectivity even after you are no longer a fugitive, right? So thinking about the ways in which Douglass talks about the precariousness of African American freedom, even in the North before the Civil War, and the ways in which the practices that enabled fugitivity were necessary to try to guarantee African American freedom even after escape from slavery.
That's Juliette Hooker. She's Associate Professor of Government and of African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. And her new book is Theorizing Race in the Americas, Douglass, Sarmiento, Du Bois, and Vasconcelos. It's published by Oxford University Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So by stressing the enduring precarity or precariousness of African Americans, even after emancipation, even after, say, buying their freedom or being given their freedom, that pushes back, would you say, against Roland's notion of a kind of episodic, the episodic nature of democracy?
I think it does. I think that rather than thinking about it, as I said, in terms of these moments, when we think about who the fugitive is, this leads us to think about, are there, for example, people who are in this precarious position, who therefore are involved perhaps in a sort of permanent way in these kind of acts of democratic renewal? And I'm thinking here, one of the examples that I point to in the chapter are, for example, the Dreamers, right, or Black Lives Matter activists today, who are exposing themselves to greater scrutiny, to, you know, potential state violence through their actions, and who are in some case literally not citizens in the case of the Dreamers, who are working to change immigration policy. And yet they're at the forefront of some of these very important struggles for justice in U.S. democracy right now, right? So I think that one of the things that focusing on actual fugitivity points to is the fact that it raises the question of whether there are those who are situated in such a way that they're, you know, sort of permanently fugitives, right? Or permanently having to enact these kind of struggles to try to perfect democracy or renew democracy.
So as I understand it, this chapter on Frederick Douglass, it looks at three kinds of episodes in Douglass's life and career. One of them is the stance he took on the proposal to relocate African Americans to parts of Central America. The second has to do with his support for the U.S. annexation of Santo Domingo, which is currently the Dominican Republic, I believe. And the third is his curation of the Haiti exhibit at the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893. And you find all of these episodes very significant. I'd like to go to that first one, which has to do with a proposal, or a set of proposals, I guess, to move African Americans to parts of Central America. Can you talk about the substance of that proposal and why he opposed it?
Yes. So before I move to that, I just want to say that the three episodes are connected by the fact that they're all examples of the way in which Douglass looked beyond the U.S. to Central America and the Caribbean at different points during his life for models of Black freedom and multiracial democracy. So one of the things that the chapter is trying to do is to show that, in contrast to the way in which we have traditionally read Douglass as only concerned or mainly concerned with domestic politics in the United States, that he actually engaged really closely with Latin America, and that when we look at these moments, we find this very interesting notion of multiracial democracy that emerges from his political thought. And one of those moments is the one you're referring to in the 1850s, prior to the Civil War, when there is a debate about what to do with African Americans, right? It's clear that it's possible that slavery will be abolished. And so the question is, what happens after? And for many, the answer to that question was that there could be no peaceful coexistence between whites and blacks in the United States, and this meant that African Americans needed to leave the United States. And for many white colonizationists, therefore, they looked for places in Central America and also in Africa where African Americans could go to form their own communities. Now, there were also African American emigrationists, right? People who believed also that it would never be possible for African Americans to achieve equality in the United States because white racism was intractable, and that therefore the best hope for Black freedom lay in emigration. Douglass opposed these proposals for African American immigration because he refused to concede that Black and white coexistence under conditions of equality was impossible. Essentially, what some of these immigrationist schemes were suggesting was that what needed to happen was the creation of a kind of Jim Crow American continent, where you had whites in the temperate northern zones, and in the tropics you would have non-whites, which is where they believed they belonged, according to these racial theories of the time. So Douglass absolutely opposed this, and he said he refused to recognize the idea of these climatic zones and the sort of climatic racial determinism of the time. And he also refused to believe that it was impossible to have a multiracial political community where whites and non-whites could not be equal citizens.
So Martin Delaney was a prominent Black abolitionist and writer. He supported, as you said, I mean, some African Americans did support Black emigration away from the U.S. What do you find interesting in the debate that he and Douglass had about over this issue?
The really interesting thing here, right, is that we know Douglass mostly for his critique of immigration, which Delaney supported. So Delaney was the most prominent advocate of African-American immigration in the 19th century, and Douglass was perhaps the most prominent opponent. But what's interesting is that in the 1850s, their positions actually converge in a certain way, right? This is after the passage of the Dred Scott decision, and Douglass is disillusioned or very skeptical about the possibility that slavery can be abolished in the United States. He's very concerned about the precariousness of African-American freedom, even in the North. And he begins at this time to actually, in a covert way, to support immigration. And this is interesting because we see this not in his own writings, but we see this in what he chooses to publish in his newspapers. So in the 1850s, in Frederick Douglass's paper, he's publishing these letters that African-American immigrants to San Juan del Norte, Nicaragua, in Central America, are sending back to his paper. He is also publishing a review of a book that talks about Nicaragua as a multiracial democracy in Central America, where colored, that's the word that's used, people are equal citizens. So his newspapers in the 1850s, in 1852 in particular, become this site, which I analyze in the book, where Douglass acts as a curator. He presents these views not under his own name, but the views of others. And so we see this kind of covert support for immigration at this moment, which goes against this this in general, at other points in his life, his critique of immigration. It's because he sees in Central America at this time the possibility of Black freedom and multiracial democracy, which he doesn't see in the U.S. at that moment.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Juliet Hooker is my guest. She's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and we are discussing her book, Theorizing Race in the Americas. It's the first book, as I understand it, to simultaneously analyze U.S., African-American, and Latin American political thinkers and their ideas about race. She's also the author of Race and the Politics of Solidarity. We have a link to her new book, Theorizing Race in the Americas, and to her faculty page at the University of Texas on our website, againstthegrain.org. And as you note in your book, Douglass also looked very approvingly at Haiti and what he saw happening there in terms of Black self-government.
Absolutely. You know, it's amazing how important Haiti was to debates about slavery in the United States at this time. In the debates about slavery in the United States, Haiti was continuously invoked, right? Haiti had been the place where you had enslaved people rebelling and simultaneously gaining independence from the colonial power of France, but also gaining their liberty. So for slaveholders throughout the Americas, Haiti was their greatest fear, right? Their greatest fear in, you know, for slaveholders and in Latin America and in the United States was that there would be another Haiti on their own soil. And so Haiti becomes this example for those who oppose emancipation of the kind of savagery that enslaved people would revert to, the kind of violence that they would engage in if they were to be allowed to throw off the bonds of slavery. And so Haiti then becomes this kind of negative example of why, you know, what of the dangers of emancipation. On the other side, for people like Douglass, Black thinkers, Haiti becomes the shining example of Black freedom, right? Of how enslaved people could gain their own freedom, could overthrow slavery, and could demonstrate that they had the political capacity to rule themselves. So Douglass is particularly interested in the fact that Haiti is a Black republic, that it is governed by Black people, and that this shows that Black people are capable of exercising political power and of being citizens.
So he's very admiring of Haiti, and yet what puzzled, I guess, at least some observers at the time is that after emancipation, after the abolition of slavery in the U.S., Frederick Douglass supported the U.S. annexation of Santo Domingo. The year was 1870, I believe. So why would Douglass advocate something like that?
This is a fascinating moment in Douglass's career, right? When he, yes, seemingly contradicts himself. Why suddenly support U.S. annexation? And what's really ironic about this debate about the annexation of Santo Domingo is that it creates some very strange alliances. So on the one hand, you have the racist anti-annexationists, right? So there are people who oppose annexation essentially because they believe that annexation would lead to the inclusion of these non-white or Black Latin Americans from the Dominican Republic into the United States, and they're concerned that this will degrade U.S. democracy. And on the other side, you have people like Douglass, who essentially are the anti-racist pro-annexationists, right? So Douglass supports U.S. expansion, which obviously would have very negative effects on not only Dominican sovereignty, but also potentially Haitian sovereignty, because he rejects, again, this idea that people of color could not be full citizens of the United States, that the U.S. could not become a multiracial democracy. So this is a fascinating moment when Douglass, during this moment, which is the height of Reconstruction in the United States, right, is very hopeful that the U.S. can become a true multiracial democracy. And so he supports the annexation of Santo Domingo because he believes that it will reshape the U.S., that it can make it a less white country, that it can help lessen white supremacy by including these Latin American states, and that this will really, you know, enhance U.S. democracy.
How important to Frederick Douglass was the right to migration, such as the right of residents of Santo Domingo to immigrate to the U.S. post-annexation?
Well, this is another of the really striking elements of Douglass's political thought that emerge when we look at his engagement with Latin America. Douglass not only supports annexation, he also, in a speech on the U.S.'s composite nationality, supports a human right to migration that would include immigration to the United States from all over the globe. So he supports Chinese immigration, Asian immigration, against which there is actually a lot of opposition at the time as well. He says the U.S. should welcome people of all colors and creeds. And his argument, right, is that the U.S. will be strengthened by welcoming immigrants and by being this place where you can have this very diverse political community. He bases this on this idea that there is a human right to movement, right? That the idea of moving to another country for better opportunities, moving to a different place, is something that is a right of all human beings, and that it would go against that idea. It's a very cosmopolitan idea of the human of a human right to migration to suggest that the U.S. should be, as he says, only the white man's country.
Yeah, and as you write in your book, or actually an article on which this chapter about Frederick Douglass in your book is based, you write that Douglass envisioned a multiracial U.S. democracy in which whiteness was decentered in multiple ways through political and social equality for African Americans and Native Americans, Asian immigration, and the addition of black/mixed-race Latin Americans, all of whom would be integral elements of a new composite nationality. So how does this notion of composite nationality fit within fugitive democratic thought, to return to one of your the theoretical strands that you follow throughout this chapter?
So one of the things that I talk about in the chapter, right, is that I think there is in Douglass's work a tension between, you know, an orientation towards something like Wolin's notion of democratic fugitivity, which seeks the remaking of the political community on more inclusive terms, right, to make it more egalitarian, and a kind of black fugitive orientation, which gestures away from seeking racial inclusion, right, that's more pessimistic about the possibility of overcoming white supremacy, and instead looks for separate sites for black freedom and black autonomy. And so I think what you see in this moment in the 1870s, when he is supporting the annexation of Santo Domingo and supporting Chinese immigration and Asian immigration and this general remaking of the United States, is that during the height of the Reconstruction era, Douglass is at a moment when he is fully committed to this idea of democratic fugitivity, right? It is a moment in which he thinks that the U.S. can really be remade on more racially egalitarian terms, and he's sort of committed to trying to focusing on the U.S. as the site for black freedom at the time. And I think the other two moments that I explore in the chapter, in 1852 and then in the 1890s, are moments in which he's actually much more pessimistic about the U.S., and instead we see these moments in which he seems to be leaning more towards what I call black fugitivity, this idea of sort of black autonomy, than we do in the 1870s.
Juliet Hooker, Associate Professor of Government and of African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the author of Theorizing Race in the Americas, Douglass, Sarmiento, Du Bois, and Vasconcelos. And we'll take a short break and speak more with Juliet about her very interesting book. Please stay with us. Thank you. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Juliet Hooker is my guest. She teaches government and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the author of Race and the Politics of Solidarity. And the book we are discussing today is her new one. It's called Theorizing Race in the Americas, which considers four African-American and Latin American thinkers: Frederick Douglass, Domingo Sarmiento, W.E.B. Du Bois, and José Vasconcelos. But we're focusing on Frederick Douglass, a towering figure in U.S. history, of course. And much of, as Juliet was saying, much of this chapter, the chapter she has in this book about Douglass, focuses on his looking beyond the U.S. to the other Americas for inspiration and for some guidance on his political thinking and the political situation of the U.S. So Frederick Douglass, he kind of sours on or becomes more pessimistic about the prospects of multiracial democracy in the U.S. How much did the failure of Reconstruction play a role in that?
It played an enormous role. I think Douglass, during Reconstruction, is convinced that the U.S. can be remade anew. You know, he says in the 1870s that it is suited, uniquely suited to being the site of, you know, the kind of multiracial policy where people of all races and creeds can be treated on equal terms. I think the failure of Reconstruction and then his treatment when he is appointed ambassador to Haiti in the 1890s and is really excoriated in the U.S. press as a result of this negotiation over a Haitian port that fails and for which Douglass is blamed, even though he's not the lead negotiator, but because he's seen as having as being too sympathetic to Haitians because of his race. I think Douglass becomes at this time very skeptical about the possibilities of racial equality in the United States. We also have to remember that the 1890s is a moment, right, of the height of the post-Reconstruction backlash and racial terror. I.W. Wells is already beginning to document the pervasive lynching and racial terror of the time, and she and Douglass are collaborating at this time. So he, I think, is becoming very concerned about the possibilities of African Americans actually gaining or even being able to preserve the gains made after the end of the Civil War.
So let's turn to another episode in Frederick Douglass's career, and that was being asked by Haiti's government, by the government of Haiti, to curate the Haiti exhibit at the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893. How did that go?
So this is an absolutely fascinating moment in Douglass's career. He is asked by the government of Haiti to organize the Haitian exhibit. And the key thing to keep in mind is that African Americans had actually been excluded from the U.S. exhibit, right? So the World's Fair was set up, the spatial design of the space was actually meant to mimic the degrees of civilization of the different races. So it went from the most to the least civilized, and all the non-white countries that were included were, of course, in the least civilized sections. And so African Americans could not be included in the U.S. exhibit because this would have somehow taken away from the U.S.'s position at the apex of civilization. So when he's asked by the Haitian government to curate their pavilion, Douglass turns it into this space where African American achievements since emancipation can be showcased. And he brings in poets like Paul Laurence Dunbar. He brings in famous African American writers and intellectuals like Ida B. Wells. And the Haitian Pavilion becomes this place where African Americans are actually represented within the World's Columbian Exposition. He also extols Haiti as this model of Black freedom and as an inspiring example of political and civic virtue by previously enslaved people. So he gives this speech on the anniversary of Haitian independence that turns the World's Columbian Exposition, which of course was supposed to be commemorating Columbus's arrival and into the Americas and the colonization of the Americas, into a celebration of the efforts by Haitian slaves to overcome French colonialism and slavery simultaneously.
And what linkages did he make between Haiti and its revolution and Black struggles in other nations, including the U.S.?
So for Douglas, Haiti was important for a number of reasons, right? One of the things that he argues is that when the Haitian slaves struck for freedom, he says, they were fighting for more than they knew, right? So that they were really striking a blow for freedom of Black people everywhere. So it really is a moment of racial solidarity for Douglas, where he argues that Haiti is an inspiring example for Blacks everywhere, including Blacks in the U.S. at this heightened moment of racial terror, because it shows both the enormous courage of which Blacks are capable, and also that they're capable of enormous political sacrifices and political achievements, even starting from the most difficult position. So he talks about how, for example, when you compare the Haitian revolutionaries to the U.S. founding fathers, right, you have on the one hand people who had all of the, in the case of the U.S. founding fathers, all of the advantages of education, social position, in comparison to the Haitian slaves who had been denied education, who had been exploited for their labor, and who nevertheless are able to achieve this great thing, which is this anti-colonial revolution that also, as he says, is the only anti-slavery revolution in the world.
And so does Frederick Douglass's praise of Haiti and its revolution, is this another example in your mind of the way in which Douglass fits within the Black fugitive thought tradition, the idea of autonomous spaces of Black freedom as opposed to an effort to somehow work within the system to renew it?
Absolutely. I think this is in the 1890s, we see Douglass moving away from, you know, his belief that the U.S. can become, you know, a multiracial democracy. And instead, we see again this sort of turn to Black fugitivity when he really is extolling the ability of these Haitian slaves to, as he says, when they were striking for their freedom, they struck for the freedom of every Black man in the world. They were linked and interlinked with their race. So it really is a moment where he argues that, you know, the fate, not only is the fate of Haiti intricately bound up with the fate of Blacks everywhere, but that this revolution was an example of the kind of model Black political agency that can serve as the basis for, you know, a form of Black fugitive hope. That even if perhaps this dream of a multiracial democracy might not be possible, there is still hope to be found in the political capacities of Black people themselves.
Juliet Hooker is my guest. She teaches at the University of Texas at Austin, and her new book is Theorizing Race in the Americas, Douglass, Sarmiento, Du Bois, and Vasconcelos. It's published by Oxford University Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain. And one thing you bring up in this chapter, and it's a striking term, because, you know, we always hear about white supremacy. Well, you write about Black supremacy, and specifically fears of Black supremacy by white supremacists, by whites who wanted to keep the racial order of white supremacy in the U.S. going after emancipation. Can you relate that to today, and to what extent race-related fears and resentments like the ones evoked by Douglass continue to the present day?
So I started writing this book while Barack Obama was still president. And one of the things that struck me as I kept doing research on Douglass was this moment when, and this is during Reconstruction in the 1870s, when he's writing about African Americans gaining the right to vote, and he starts mocking these opponents of giving the franchise to African Americans who are worried that the end result will be that there will be a black emperor who will have a white wife and a court of many colors where whites will be made to be servile and will be lorded over by African Americans. And he's basically sort of mocking his contemporaries and saying, you don't really need to worry about, you know, these fears of black supremacy, right? And of course, the reason he's mocking them is because it's just preposterous to think of that simply giving African Americans who had recently been slaves simply the right to vote would somehow lead to them taking over, completely dominating politics in the United States. And so what was striking to me as I was reading this was all of the accusations and the criticisms of Barack Obama as this person who was, you know, overreaching his power, and the fact that his election had somehow led to, you know, I remember there was, I think, a segment on Fox News about white kids being beaten up by black kids on a bus, on a school bus. And so this whole fear that having one African-American president had somehow completely reversed the U.S. racial order, and suddenly whites were being discriminated against left and right, seemed to me reminiscent of the fears of black supremacy and of a black emperor that Douglass is writing about more than a century ago. And so there are some striking parallels between, you know, how the mere idea of, you know, not even equality, but just an advance, right? There's only been one African-American president in the whole history of the United States, that somehow that one fact will somehow completely reverse the racial order that has existed for centuries.
And what about xenophobia today and the targeting and demonization of immigrants? How relevant is Frederick Douglass's stance on migration and the right to migration to the current debate and furor, really?
Well, this was, again, you know, you think you're writing about somebody who is, right, you know, lived during the 19th century, and suddenly their arguments seem even more prescient and relevant than you could imagine. So Douglass's articulation of this ideal of the U.S. as a place that is welcoming for immigrants and that would benefit from immigration, and his championing of the idea of a human right to migration was such a contrast to the proposals of banning Muslims, of building border walls, this sort of anti-immigrant sentiment that seems to be running so rampant in so many sectors of the United States today, that it really, I think, is instructive to think that someone like Douglass could have this very open cosmopolitan vision of what the U.S. could be that seems to be lacking for so many people who are so afraid of that possibility today. And one can only hope that, in fact, Douglass does become more and more influential.
You know, we've only talked about one of the four thinkers that you discuss and analyze in this book, and we agree to devote a lot of time to Frederick Douglass, but you also discuss Domingo Sarmiento and W.E.B. Du Bois and José Vasconcelos in this book, Theorizing Race in the Americas. Can you tell us a little bit about the other thinkers?
Sure. The book, as I said earlier is structured around these pairings, right? So so Douglas's chapter is paired with a chapter on a very influential Argentinian statesman and thinker, Domingo Faustino Sarmiento, who goes on to become president of Argentina and who is seen as this advocate of Europeanization and as somebody who really look to Europe as the model for Latin America. So what I do in that chapter is actually to show how Sarmiento, who lived in the U.S. during a short period of time during Reconstruction, actually turns to the U.S. fairly early on in his career and looks to it as a model for Latin America. And so one of the things that I do is talk about how he, like Douglas, turns to the other America for inspiration. And so that's the sort of parallel between their two chapters. And one of the things that I show is also how they both have these kind of romanticized ideas of the other America that then become useful as they stake out their own political and theoretical projects. So Sarmiento also has a very interesting misreading of U.S. history that allows him to make certain interventions into Argentinian and Latin American political debates. And then the second half of the book is devoted to two chapters on W.B. Du Bois and José Vasconcelos, the Mexican philosopher. And the interesting thing there is that Du Bois is usually seen as this example of, you know, the kind of U.S. focus on a black-white racial binary that doesn't acknowledge the existence of mixture, whereas Vasconcelos is one of the preeminent proponents of the idea that Latin America is defined by racial and cultural mixture and that this is the essence of Latin American identity. And so what I do in those two chapters is to show how actually Du Bois, interestingly, also is also writing about racial mixture very much in a lot of his work in the 1920s and 1930s. So I look at how for these two very different thinkers in their writings produced in the 1920s and 1930s, racial mixture becomes this way of trying to think about how to challenge global white supremacy and how to think about what a post-racist future would look like, right? What a future beyond racism would look like. So they have to engage in these sort of feats of political imagination, right? Because they're writing during these times when, you know, in the U.S., you know, you have this attempt to ban interracial marriages, right? So mixture is something that's literally against the law in many places. And in Latin America, where you still have people who think, you know, have adopted U.S. racist science, the tenets of U.S. racist science, and believe that the reason Latin America is backward is because of the existence of mixture. And so both Vasconcelos and Du Bois, I argue, use these narratives of racial mixture, what I call their mestizo futurisms, to try to engage in these acts of political imagination that allow them to think about what an anti-colonial movement against global white supremacy might look like.
Juliet Hooker, Associate Professor of Government and of African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. And again, on againstthegrain.org, we have a link to her new book. It's called Theorizing Race in the Americas, Douglas, Sarmiento, Du Bois, and Vasconcelos. Congratulations, Juliet, on the book, and thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me, CS.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.